Welcome, everyone, to the Ontolog Forum meeting of Thursday, March 12, 2009. Today is a special panel session in preparation for Ontology Summit 2009, entitled Ontology Community Perspectives Toward Ontology-Based Standards, which is the topic for this year's summit. This week, we will be taking what might be called the ontological perspective to this question, and we've assembled a panel of people who have worked both in the ontology community as well as the standards community to give some insights into what ontologies have to offer to the standards community. Our panelists today include Professor Barry Smith from the State University of New York at Buffalo, Ed Barkmeyer from the National Institute of Standards and Technology, Bill McCarthy from Michigan State University, and Conrad Bach from the National Institute of Standards and Technology. I will be breaking with some tradition in this meeting. Instead of starting off with my slides as session chair, I will hand it right over to Barry Smith, who has, I believe, has some time constraints, and so we'll hear his talk first. I'm not sure if Barry needs much introduction in this particular community, but Barry, as head of the National Center for Biomedical Ontology Research and also the National Center of Ontological Research, in addition to all this work that Barry has been doing within ontologies, this has also led him to encounter some of the standards work that's being done within the healthcare community. And as a result of his experiences there, Barry has a lot of insight into some of the, so to say, problems that have arisen in attempting to standardize certain concepts within the healthcare community. And today, Barry will be talking about, if I can get his slide up here, how to organize the world of ontologies. So, Barry, take it away.
Hello, Michael, and hello, Peter, and hello, everybody else. The first slide is called How to Organize the World of Ontologies, and as I'm sure everyone knows, this is a very difficult kind of proposition, and I'm certainly not today going to propose an answer to this question. Rather, I'm going to describe what is being done within the biomedical world in order to address the question as it arises within one specific domain. I'd like to say in advance that I think that there are analogies with what's been going on in the standards domain, which can be described as follows. Standards have been created thus far in an ad hoc way in response to opportunistic needs and requirements, and there has been little or no meta-level organization devoted to questions like how can we achieve one standard for each particular purpose? How can we refactor standards so that standards which have been achieved in one area can be utilized in other areas? There are attempts to do these things within the framework of organizations like ISO, but ISO responds opportunistically to standards proposals from the outside. ISO, as I understand it, does not itself determine the need for a standard ab initio. So if we move to slide two, the idea underlying the work I will describe is an idea which sees the need for ontologies as being rooted in the problem of data silos. In biomedicine, there are huge numbers of different heterogeneous bodies of data which are collected by different groups for different purposes with different formats and different kinds of content, but which, if one is going to do full justice to the biological data available about how organisms work and fail to work, need to be integrated in useful ways if the full opportunities available to contemporary medicine are to be exploited. The reason for ontologies is how do we solve this problem of integration, or in other words, how do we prevent the creation of data siloed. And my own view is that this is the primary reason why one should be interested in ontologies. Ontologies are our life's desperate hope for counteracting what I believe are inevitable tendencies of people to create conflicting and competing terminologies and databases. What we try to do in the biomedical domain is to create constraints on the freedom that people have to create terminologies and databases by using ontology standards. Now, of course, we've been only partially successful, but I think I can say that we have been successful. That is to say, there are now many people who are working within the framework that we've created because they agree with us that there is a need to try and prevent the formation of silos. The idea is that if you are creating a database or a terminology or any similar resource, and if you join the effort that we are sponsoring, then you will create your resource in such a way that it will be maximally conformant with the other resources already existing within the framework. And if we move to slide 3, the part of the work is based upon ENCORE's contributions, which are primarily centered around two artifacts: basic formal ontology, which is a very small top-level ontology designed primarily to support scientific research, and then the relation ontology, which is an even smaller ontology. Actually, it's more like a list of relations that we recommend for use, particularly by people building biomedical ontologies. So if an ontology is a graph, then the relations in the relation ontology are the admissible edges. And these are edges like is, are, and part of. So the relation ontology is deliberately designed to be very simple, but to provide a standard reading of terms like is, are, and part of, both from a formal point of view and then also from a formatting point of view. If you move to slide 4, ENCORE's work has been from the start based on the idea that if you're going to be effective using ontology technology, then you have to test everything that you do vigorously and rigorously. So you test guidelines, basically, for building ontologies, linking, evaluating, applying ontologies. And we were very lucky in that we had a number of highly influential biologists working with biomedical data who agreed to work with us in testing our ontology proposals in the domain of biology. And slide 5, the idea is that the tests will yield what we regard always tentatively as best practices for developing ontologies and for organizing ontologies. And the result is what we call the OVO Foundry. Now, the OVO Foundry is a collection of ontologies which are built from the start or are reformed in such a way as to be maximally compatible. And the goal here is to have one ontology maximally for every domain of biomedicine. And how that one ontology per domain is to be understood is somewhat complicated. So there are many thousands of diseases, for instance. It may not be the case that we will include many thousands of disease ontologies within the OVO Foundry, but it may also be the case that we do indeed include many thousands of disease ontologies within the OVO Foundry. Now, we have guidelines for ensuring modularity, that is to say, for ensuring that each part of the OVO Foundry works with the other parts. And the idea is being imitated. So OVO Foundry was created by groups working primarily in those areas of biology which are relevant to human health research. So they include mouse biologists, for instance, where the mouse biologists are working on mouse models of human disease. Now the model is being imitated in the sense that other groups, still primarily within biology, are taking up the OVO Foundry strategy for modularity, are using some of the OVO Foundry ontologies, but they're applying them in different domains. The first one is the Neuroscience Information Framework Foundry, which is a large NIH organization with rich ontology resources, which are now being organized in the Foundry way. also now have an evolutionary biology ontologies foundry, which is a biology group organizing their ontologies for evolutionary biology purposes in the foundry way. And we have an environment ontologies foundry, which is organizing geography and geospatial ontologies using the foundry model and to some extent collaborating with the original foundry sponsors. This is being implemented quite successfully. All of the ontology developers who have commit themselves to the foundry have agreed to use basic formal ontology as a common top level. They all agree to subject their ontologies to peer review by other ontology developers within the foundry. The foundry ontologies are now being used by thousands of researchers to promote interoperability. And the really nice thing is that ontologies finally are beginning to die off. So I believe that we will make progress in solving the silo problem only when ontologies die. And what this means is that people should stop using multiple ontologies for a given domain and should pick the best one, and they should all collaborate on improving the best single ontology to promote interoperability. And now slide 7, the unifying goal in the OGO Foundry is integration of data, not just across domains such as diseases, but also across species, across level of granularity, across perspectives, and so forth. And on slide 8, you can see the organization. So there is a small fragment now of the foundry since it's become bigger since this slide was created. We have at the bottom the OGO Foundry ontologies in the biological, biomedical sense, including some biochemistry ontologies. In the middle, we have organizing ontologies. We have an information artifact ontology, which will eventually be, we hope anyway, be adopted by people outside biology. At the moment, it's being built by people with an interest in biomedical information integration needs. We have an ontology for biomedical investigations, which is in effect an experiment ontology. And then we have a spatial ontology. All of the ontologies are unified together within the basic formal ontology, which also determines the structure of the modular organization for the biology ontologies, which you can see on slide 9. So the BOFO is divided into continuance on the one hand and occurrence or processes on the other hand, with independent and dependent continuance being respectively the objects or things, such as molecules or organisms, and the qualities and functions, which are the dependent continuance. And you can see the organization as it looks within the BOFO perspective on the next slide, which is slide 9. And I will just describe briefly on slide 10 three examples, the heading is wrong. The OB is the ontology for biomedical investigations. If you go to the next slide, you'll see the cell ontology. The cell ontology I'm using as an example here merely in order to illustrate how we succeed in having these ontologies built in such a way that they are conformant to the basic formal ontology top level. The answer is that we import basic formal ontology, in this case into Protégé, and then people who are building the ontologies construct the ontology by populating downwards. So a cell is an object, and all cell types are subtypes of the type cell, and therefore also subtypes of the type object, and therefore also subtypes of the type independent continuant, and so on. This turns out to be a very valuable guideline for people developing ontologies because it tells them where to start. And the biologists who've been using this strategy have been very appreciative of the ways in which they get benefits because the problems that arise when one uses a framework like BOFO have already been addressed by other biologists, and so they can profit from the lessons learned as time goes by. And then slide 13, this is just a list of the OB collaborating communities. These are communities of people doing high-throughput biological experimentation. As you can see, see there are some quite important communities involved in this effort. And again, we have empirical evidence that the OB ontology helps these people to address a huge need of data integration in a way which provides them with guidelines as to how to start building ontologies in a way that ensures interoperability. And then the final example is the infectious disease ontology. There are several thousand infectious diseases alone, and there is still no good ontology approach to dealing with the data which comes from infectious diseases, even though data analysis here can be very important in identifying new diseases, for instance, and in helping to create vaccines. So we created the Infectious Disease Ontology Consortium as part of the OVO Foundry, and this is just a list of the initial members of the consortium, all of whom have agreed to create infectious disease ontologies for their own specific diseases, sometimes multiple diseases, using the same infectious disease ontology core, which we've created centrally, as it were, as part. And then the final slide, slide 15. We believe that the OVO Foundry provides a standard. In a generalized sense, it provides guidelines for building ontologies, guidelines for linking ontologies, guidelines for training ontologists. And we believe that it fulfills what are three criteria for a successful standard. First of all, we think we've demonstrated that non-ontology experts can follow our guidelines. The documentation that we've developed is, we think, intelligible even to users who are not familiar with ontology technology. We have a track record, so we're not building a standard which is a top-down standard which might or might not work. We're building a standard always on the basis of an incremental approach, starting out with what works and then moving on to the next stage. And we have lots of existing users. And my view is that ontologies are like telephone networks. If you have an ontology with wonderful structure but no users, then you have nothing. If you have an ontology with many users but the structure still needs help, then you have everything because you have people who can help you make it better. So that's all I have to say, Michael. I don't know what we do next. Do I put myself on mute once again?
Oh, thanks, Barry. So what were your time constraints?
I have a few minutes for questions.
Okay, so I think in that case what we'll do is we'll just open up for questions right now since you won't be around for the final discussion.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sorry for that.
No, it's okay. So do people have any questions for Barry at this time? Steve, I think you have a question. Your hand's raised. Steve, right?
Stop. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah, I did start three. Okay. Barry, real quick, I'm curious what your experience has been with the population part. How formal does that have to be, and how successful are you at getting domain experts in getting that formal?
So the reason I chose the cell ontology and the OB and IDO as my three examples is because there we have groups who have effectively trained themselves to do the full formal work. So basically they've got at least as far as OWL-DL formality. In the case of the cell ontology, they're using common logic level articulateness in order to capture some of the features that they need to capture. So in those three cases, we're doing pretty well. In some of the other cases, we have the basic buffo structure, which brings that degree of formality because all of buffo, at least, is available in OWL-DL. But they don't always go very much further than that in populating downwards. However, they do at least have natural language definitions, and in the most important cases, work is underway to turn those natural language definitions into proper formal definitions.
Okay, where I was coming from in particular, in the spirit of where this summit is going, is how we're going to be able to get the standards community people who may be at best, doing information modeling, but at worst even just writing documents, brought into the ontological way of thinking.
Yeah, I think that really the only way is evangelists. You need to be very lucky in finding evangelists who are clever enough and persuasive enough that they can sit through long meetings and persuade other people of the virtues of what you can do with ontologies. And in biology, we have a number of such people. But that's really, I think, a matter of being lucky.
Samir, I just have one question just before you leave. So how have the different biomedical ontologies, how are they being used by the practitioners? And what kind of benefits have you seen in the use of ontologies, as opposed to, say, something that would be a less formal specification of the domain?
Good. So the one very minimal benefit, which was surprising, the OB is an ontology for describing experiments, so clinical trials, for instance. And the Federal Drug Administration requires experiments to be described in a standardized way. And OB is being used now by people to create standardized descriptions of experiments for regulatory purposes. They don't need any formal reasoning in order to do that, but the vocabulary already is structured in a sufficiently adequate way that it meets regulatory hurdles. And that was a benefit that we didn't anticipate. A second example would be there are several very large databases being developed for biosurveillance purposes, for instance. And there you're dealing, again, with multiple diseases, multiple kinds of data, and you want to deal with it in such a way that the data is integrated, if possible, from the very start. And it turns out that you can take OB and turn it into a database schema which is rich enough to cope with the biology, but which is also adequate enough to cope with all of the different kinds of data very easily. And so the nice thing is that as OB evolves, then the database schema also becomes richer without losing the formal coherence. So those are two rather easy applications which are already proving very successful.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, those are two nice, very nice examples.
So I'm afraid I need to leave now.
Well, thank you very much, Barry. I appreciate that you took some the time there to give us some of these insights. Thanks very
much. Good. So thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, our next speaker will be Ed Bartmeyer from the National Institute of Standards and Technology. He will be presenting a little talk on the use of ontologies in standards. Ed is another person who's kind of ideally suited for this panel. He's been working at NIST for quite some time, I think since the 80s. And in that time, he's been working in the Manufacturing Systems Integration Division and also has been quite involved in a number of ISO-related projects and, I believe, more recently, some OMG projects. Ed, you can start. R3 to unmute.
Okay. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Good. Okay. That's what I needed to know. Okay. The first part is there. Thank you, Michael. I should say, by the way, Michael also worked at NIST for a while and in several of the same projects, so we have had a couple of encounters along the way. So I'm going to go sort of quickly. First of all, I'm not really going to talk about what we are doing. I'm really going to pitch this at the issue of trying to use ontologies and standards and trying to get people to use ontologies and standards. And for the most part, my activities have been involved in information technology standards. Admittedly, information technology standards for manufacturing and so on, but the fact is they're still information technology standards. I have never been involved in what I should describe as standards of practice in manufacturing, for example, although there are a good many of those as well. And I want to make that distinction because we're going to come up very quickly on the distinction in thinking that goes with those different domains. First step, however, is I've got a quick outline here which simply says, I'm on slide two, which just says, I'm going to talk about four things. First of all, what kind of standards there are. Secondly, I'm going to talk a little bit about, of all things, the OMG model-driven architecture and its relevance. Then we come to the relevance part, which is the role of ontologies. And finally, I was going to say a little bit about ontology languages or equivalently languages for concept capture. So with that brief introduction, we go to slide three. This is a nomenclature that's been around in various forms. You'll see versions of it with different terms. And I'm trying to make a distinction here that turns out to be a very visible distinction in what kinds of information technology standards get made. One of them is what I've called here exchange standards. Other people refer to them as document standards or as publication standards. They are standards that define a form in which information will be published. And typically the idea is that some software tool which has gathered information in the course of doing whatever it does, much of which may be dealing with human users or with equipment or whatever, right, it has accomplished, it has established a lot of knowledge, and what it does is to export that knowledge in some standard form. In those cases, it doesn't have any idea, for the most part, what is going to be done with that knowledge. It may have some opinions, but in fact, for example, if you take a CAD system, a perfectly great manufacturing example, a computer-aided design system, it's capturing typically now a solid model, a geometric model of the manufactured object, the manufactured part. The solid model is very important to a whole bunch of applications. The CAD system itself is typically aware in the sense that its vendor, the vendor that produces it, knows something about what those applications are. The work is done primarily in creating the model with a human and with a human engineer. When the model is created, you need to be able to export it. You export the entire model, everything that you know, or at least everything that you are able to capture, in a form that can be actually used by the engineer for whatever purpose. Sometimes what that purpose is to take this model now and to perform some categories of engineering analysis to determine whether the part is going to meet certain standards for the behavior of strength or heat or whatever. The other behavior is that it may very well go to another engineer whose job is to figure out how you're going to actually make that piece of material using the kinds of equipment that the engineer has. So he's going to take the same design, but he's going to be much more concerned now with the behavior of the geometry with respect to what kinds of machines can cut or form those surfaces and those structures. So the particular behavior here is that the published document out of the CAD system has many uses, and the CAD system is unaware of where it's going, and it's simply publishing a document. And so the document standard is going to define a form, it's going to define what information goes in the document, and it's going to define a structure in which that information will be presented. That structure will include things like, you know, whether you use left brackets or pointy brackets or periods or whatever to delimit fields, and how long fields are perhaps, and all kinds of things of that form. But it will also, and there are typically languages that are going to be used to do that. Everybody is familiar with XML schema as the current vogue language for doing things like that. XML schema is the fourth in a long line. And Michael is right. I've been around this business for a long time. And I've been in the manufacturing part of it for the last 30 years. The fact is that there are a lot of these languages. Right now, the big one is XML schema. The idea is these things define how the data is going to be presented, but you still need to know what the information is. Somebody's got to talk about what the information is. And in most of these standards, what the information is commonly represented in natural language. There is a description of what the physical document structure element is, and the natural language beside it says, oh, and this is where you put this information. All right? The second case, and the second type of information, of IT standard, is a bit different. It's what I've called here an interface standard. It is exactly the domain of the service-oriented architecture and things of that form. Interface standards are about how a tool talks to a specific other tool or a specific kind of tool to get certain kinds of services performed. In that case, you're directing the conversation. It's not, here is everything I know. It's, here is what you will need to know to do what I want you to do, and you will tell me what you found out in the course of doing that. That's the type of interface structure that occurs. So you're defining there not a document that is everything I know, but a particular interaction for providing a service. And the simplest case of these things are the cases in which you simply define, I will send you a message that has this information in it, and you will do whatever you do, and maybe you will even answer it. Okay? And the typical, you know, the typical web service view of the world is that they're all structured that way. I will send you a message, you will send me an answer. And those things have, those things again are defined by data structures, but here they are making presumptions about what else you may already know. In fact, a lot of the information that's provided here is half of the information on the, or less, on the basis of the idea that I know who you are and you will know certain other things that I don't have to tell you in this interface. So there's a lot less information being provided and it's very selective. It's about what I need you to do. The extreme case of this, by the way, I'm going to list at the bottom and say very little more about, is the case of complex interactions, where instead of having a simple, I send you a message and you do whatever I ask you to do and you send an answer back, you have a complex interaction in which I send you a message which starts a process, you tell me about things that you will need to know to continue the process, I give you some of that information, you ask me whether something else needs to be done, you tell me that something interesting happened and ask me to decide whether to take action and so on, and there's a long complex sequence of interactions that actually produce the interface between the two systems. One can think of that as a set of messages, but an important part of that is what the rules for the interchange are, how the messages themselves, what kind of choreography occurs in our, I do this step and you end up over here and then you do that step and send a message back over here and so on. So all of this is the distinction between the two schemes. One of the schemes is I publish what I know and I have a document form that describes it. The other is I send you the information you need to do something, and you send me the information you get coming back. And that's a very directed kind of information exchange. Now, having said that there are two different ones, I'm going to go and look at what OMG developed, which is, by the way, in a certain sense a canonization or a clarification of an idea that is simply software engineering, as developed originally around 1980. But Richard Solly came up with a clean way of describing this in 2001 or two, and that is what OMG calls the model-driven architecture. The idea that OMG was engaged in at that time, OMG is the Korba people, okay? That was their original product. It was all about devising distributed systems which had simple interfaces that looked like so-called object invocations. The idea of the model-driven architecture was, I'm on slide 4, over the model-driven architecture, was that you define conceptual interface models, a model that says, this is the interaction we need to perform. This is the information that we'll need to flow through that, without getting into exactly what the data form is and what the technical form of the interface is going to be. So the idea of this was that Richard had the benefit of sitting through 12 years of development, actually probably 15 years of development of what is going to be the distributed systems technology of the month. Alright, so the first one is something that isn't even on the list here, which was called DCE back in the 1980s. And there followed Richard's brainchild, which his and others, which was Korba, and then in 1992, which was about 89-90, and then in 1992, Sun, in the person of Jim Gosling, developed Java, which became basically another means of doing distributed systems, and finally Microsoft, having been left out of that, we had to do it again with web services, with XML, beginning around 2000. The whole idea is that the conceptual interface doesn't depend on which of these you actually used, and the specific details of how you're going to do it don't make a difference to what you're doing and what information you need to convey and what the interactions between the agents really are. And that was what the idea of the model-driven architecture is, that you develop what they called a platform-independent model, by which they meant simply a description of what's going to happen and what information is going to be conveyed without regard to exactly what the data forms and the technology of conveyance is. You can go and harden that later to decide how we're really going to work with this thing, but you still have to first puzzle out exactly what the interface is going to be, and then you can get into arguments about whether we're going to do it straight with Java or we're going to use Korba or we're going to use a mixture of those two to actually implement it. The big step from OMG's point of view was that it allowed them to push their second big product, which was UML, the Unified Modeling Language. And the whole idea was that this abstracted interface model could be phrased in a language that wasn't actually bound to implementations directly, which was the Unified Modeling Language. And the Unified Modeling Language, for this purpose, has two sets of concepts, which are called interfaces and activities. The activities will show you what the interaction looks like. The interface specifications will tell you what it is that I'm going to say to him and what he's going to say back to me. Okay? And that's what, not how. And that's the important part of it. The thing that came up when they started trying to make standards doing this was the realization, which, by the way, is actually standardized as a realization in something called, something called RMODP, the Reference Model for Open Distributed Processing, vintage about 1992. It's an ISO standard. I can remember the numbers, but it doesn't make any difference. The idea of RMODP was you need to think about a whole lot of things in designing a distributed system. And it categorized these things into what they call different viewpoints. One of the viewpoints in RMODP, which is the one that the OMG people rapidly discovered they needed, is the idea of the shared information model. No matter what I'm going to say to you and what you're going to say to me, we have to have a background model of what the world looks like and what this element that I'm going to provide you is in relationship to other elements. So it is a description of the problem-solution space. And if that sounds like an ontology, well, yeah, that's what it means. That's where we're going. The shared information model was needed to do the conceptual interface model. You need to know what it is that are the entities, what are the things we're actually talking about, and what properties do they have, and how are they related to one another. So that is what is actually captured in the shared information model. And, of course, in the OMG MDA form, the model-driven architecture, you use UML primitives to capture these things, which are called classes and associations. Okay, which are in OWL called classes and properties. It's the same basic ideas. And the interesting thing is that as you started to see what happened with the OMG MDA process, many, many of the what were supposed to have been conceptual interfaces actually just became knowledge publications. They became things like the exchange standards, in which having developed the shared information model, it turns out that there are tools who do nothing more than capture all that information and publish it. In particular, UML tools do exactly that. They capture models and publish them. So the whole idea here is that many of these information models themselves then have realizations, not as some interface technology, but just as an exchange standard defined in something like XML schema. And that's really what happened to the model-driven architecture. The reason why I've brought up the model-driven architecture is that right now, the model-driven architecture is really very popular in the software engineering community. And well, it should be. I would say, apostles of intelligent software engineering have been pushing something like the model-driven architecture for 25, 30 years. The first ones that I can remember that were promulgating things like this was something called Structured Analysis and Design, vintage around 1980. So the idea has been prevalent. It's now got an official name. It's got an official language in which to do it, and the official language is UML. But the idea that you build the concept model and then define the software elements that implement the concept model as needed for particular purposes is the distinction that is being promoted under the MDA approach. And now we come to the role of ontology, slide 5. The whole idea is that the information model is, in fact, a weak form of ontology. It is the list of the concepts used in the specification, the classes, the properties, the information units, and the constraints in some language which was devised to do some kind of information systems design. UML, in its third incarnation, is actually a very good, relatively very good abstraction level. And it has all of these applications. It extends to exchange standards, it extends to interface standards, and we will come to the last issue, is that once you have a means of capturing a common vocabulary as a set of classes and properties and information units and constraints that describes your world, this clearly applies to much more than just the IT standards. You can use that kind of thing to describe standards of practice in general. It is simply concept for when you are doing this, you must take this step and that step and the third step, all involve referring to objects that are well-defined in the domain and are well-defined as to how do they relate to one another. So the whole idea that originated here from an information technology concept really does apply to simply getting a good, solid vocabulary, well-defined, for the purpose of doing whatever standard you're going to make. And as Barry said, the situation is that right now we have a lot of standards in which the vocabularies are written in natural language and aren't captured in any formal way, which doesn't mean they couldn't be made formal from what they are. The whole idea of the MDA is pushing software people in recognizing that the vocabulary is a critical part of the engineering process. When you're making the standard, the first thing you must do is to define the concepts and the relationships among the concepts and not bury that in the actual implementation technology. And that is the big step. And the problem is only, then, what language do you capture it in? And I think this is really where the trouble spot lies. Because what I'm observing here and what I observed in a talk that I made about a year ago is that information models are a primitive form of ontology. UML is just, you know, is just the poor man's owl. It's a way of capturing the same kinds of concepts that was geared toward people who are educated in software design. And what you really want to think of is take that model and look at what information content is in it, what knowledge content is in it, and what you see is that you've got something that is a primitive ontology. And the question is, can we now take that same community, that same approach, and ask these people to move on? Can you actually use a language which was designed for reasoning rather than a language which was designed simply to be converted to software? So that leads me to slide 6 and last. The issue is, in what languages are we going to capture our concepts? What people currently do in all of the standards is to do it in natural language. There is no structured syntax, and there is no obvious formal interpretation. And in fact, in many cases, you will find that the definitions and some of the specifications are ambiguous because the words are a little bit ambiguous. The formal interpretation is missing. In UML, there is a certain amount of formality. But the biggest problem they have is that in UML, all classes and properties are intrinsically primitive. There is no concept in UML of defining a class or defining a property in terms of another property. The best you can do is you can write a certain set of constraints which could actually be treated as axiomatic in some cases, but it takes a very strong discipline to be sure that what you write is something that is treated as an axiomatic constraint. In effect, it comes down to knowing exactly how to use UML to create something as near to an ontology as you can. Otherwise, UML itself has only a semi-formal interpretation. Conrad Bock will probably argue about this. He was part of the formal interpretation of UML gang. But the fact is that it's only a semi-formal interpretation. It does not actually have an axiomatic definition of what its own primitives are. And that's sort of where the problem lies. So we can move up to something like OWL. In OWL, most properties are still primitive. You don't define relations in terms of one another, and you don't define relations axiomatically. But many classes in OWL, the whole idea of OWL, is to allow classes to be defined. And OWL itself, as a language, has a formal interpretation. We know how to reason with OWL because we know what the OWL concepts exactly mean. And that's what is lacking in UML. We have to add those tightening ideas to the UML concepts, which means that some uses of them in UML won't qualify. And that's one of the issues. Finally, you come to the idea that if you could use first-order logic languages, then you can actually do all, in effect, of your classes and property definitions by axioms. If it has these properties, it is one. And that has got a pure formal interpretation. But now we come to the last bullet. So, okay, we could do all of these things, and there may be some intermediate things. Right now, the reason is the bullet at the bottom is the critical problem. People know how to read natural languages, and software engineering people, and a lot of others, as I've begun to discover, are beginning to learn how to read UML, because it's not that complicated. There is no standard graphical representation of OWL, and there is no text representation of OWL that is commonly used. What is commonly used is the XML representation of OWL, which is extremely hard for people to read. So one of the problems and those of us who have worked with languages like Cliff realize that you have to be a logician to love it. No one else is ever going to read that language, and that's sort of the way it goes. So the problem that we have at the end of this process is that we know what we want them to do. We want a lot of software engineers particularly to use the MDA concept and to move from using UML as the means of capturing their world model into using something more like OWL as a means of capturing their world model. And you know what? To do that, we've got to give them a more accessible notation. Because really, they could do it, they're prepared to do it, but they're just not ready because there is no notation. They are not being taught to use it. They're being taught to use UML. And that's what's going to happen for a long time until we can get past the problem of standard representations in languages that people can read. Because if you don't do that, all of the underlying technology is only wonderful for the logicians. And sorry, that's kind of my message. And I guess I should stop here.
Thanks, Ed. That was great. I think what we'll do is, like, from here on in, we'll listen to all the speakers, and then we'll open it up for discussions at the end, unless the speakers also feel interested in answering any questions that might arise during the chat session that the team has right now. But if people have questions, they can post that during the chat session, and speakers can address those. So we'll move on to our third speaker, Bill McCarthy from Michigan State University. Again, another person who has actively worked in ontologies, and specifically Bill's been working with the accounting ontology, REA, as well as on the standard side. I believe he's been working with OAG and OMG. And so Bill's talk today is Ontology-Driven Standards, the Natural Tension. Peter?
Yeah, I'm here. Bill McCarthy. I guess, can I get some feedback from Mike? Can you hear me?
Yep, that's good.
Okay, good. All right. Well, I certainly feel like I'm the least formal person on the set of presenters here. So, and actually, most of my slides are just a run-up to my final slide. Sort of like my two prior speakers, I'm not going to talk so much about what exactly I'm doing, although I have to use the examples from that. But I sort of wanted to talk about some of the natural tensions that occur between these two communities, between standards communities and ontologists. So that's really going to be sort of the theme of my presentation. So as you can see on my slide, they're numbered McCarthy 1, McCarthy 2. I'm really a professor of accounting. That's my day job. And I've been developing an accounting model which now has morphed into the ontology domain for a number of years for teaching, for research, and now for use in standardization. I was part of the EBXML group. I got drawn into that because they were looking for a model for a business process, choreography between two trading partners trying to undergo some kind of a business collaboration. And from EBXML, I was drawn into ISO and the OpenEDI group, and I also stayed with one of the EBXML organizers, UNCFACT. So now I'm working on three different standards. In ISO, SC32, Working Group 1, I work with the OpenEDI people, and we have an ontology for OpenEDI, which is determined, which has been called the Accounting and Economic Ontology. That's 159.444. And I'm also working on part three now, which is the OpenEDI descriptive techniques, which actually connects with my UNCFACT work, where we're trying to get an REA specialization of the UMM, which is the UNCFACT modeling methodology. So, and I'm also an active member, although not as active as other people, on the Ontolog list. So let me go to slide number two here. This just shows you, as Ed just mentioned, that I'll try to use his words. This is an example of a shared information model that we did have in entity relationship form. Now it's actually in UML class diagram form. This tells you the classes and the associations between them that we have in a normal business process. Now, I know ontologies are not supposed to use colors because they're not computable or machine-readable, but actually one of the biggest uses of this ontology is actually for teaching, and we find that the teaching to accounting students about what a business process is and what are the critical sets of things and how do you reason with them in the accounting domain is facilitated by the colors. Although this particular model here does fit on a page, it does get pretty complex, and it takes 2.5 to 3 months to show it and teach it to a group of accounting students who are trying to build accounting models that are eventually implemented in some kind of a database language. This is sort of the M2 level. It just sort of shows you the pattern for what we expect in accounting for a business process. On the next page, we have sort of an example of that. this is the same prior model. Ed ought to be proud of me. I'm doing it in UML class diagrams with stereotypes. So the stereotypes on page 3 are very simply the model elements that you saw on page 2. This shows you a typical manufacturing component in terms of the number of classes and the associations between the classes that we would expect in an accounting manufacturing process. So let me go on to slide 4. This is a diagram that actually my final slide uses when I talk about the tensions between this community. I'm sure it's a diagram that many, many people in this community have seen many, many times. It's from Leo Oberst. I have adapted it somewhat to the world of accounting. You can see where I sort of stuck the REA accounting ontology. Perhaps that's a little bit high in terms of its sort of ER model sort of morphing toward a UML model. And there's been some very limited work in doing logical models with this thing. But the whole idea of this slide, slide number 4, is that the further on up you move, the better your chances for eventually coming up with very good interoperable models. And the further on down you move, the more you limit your actual chances in what you're trying to develop for interoperability. And you can see very down at the bottom we have a lot of what generally characterizes accounting interoperability, which is very, very primitive, coded words that sort of try to tell you what's going on in this information structure that virtually no one outside the immediate group of people who used it in one particular company or for one particular software actually can understand. And then as we sort of move up to common taxonomies and then common definitions and thesauri up to conceptual models, we enlarge the possibilities for interoperability, okay? Okay, so let me go on to slide number 5. This is a slide that actually shows you the basic tensions that occur in interoperability. We did have a workshop that was very generously sponsored by the National Science Foundation under the direction of Frank Olkin last year, where we tried to get everybody involved with financial interoperability standards. And to start off the workshop, we sort of showed this slide. It looks like it's kind of complex, but it really is just showing some of the basic tensions. As you look at, and I'm on slide McCarthy 5 now, on the left hand and the vertical axis, it shows you from low to high, and that goes back to the Leo Oberst type of interoperability standards that we talked about before. You can aim for standards that have very low interoperability possibilities all the way up to standards that are going to have very high interoperability standards. And on the horizontal axis, we have what is very critical to practitioners. You can try to get your interoperability standards done relatively quickly, or you can try to get them exactly right and do the best you can, but of course that makes more time or uses more time, okay? The first dimension, like I said, is the vertical axis. The second dimension is the horizontal axis. And the third dimension, which is shown by actually the benefits measured by the size of the circles, again, shows you the basic tensions. So, for instance, if I start out at the origin of the basic graph that I'm showing you here, point B shows you one that does get done relatively quickly, but as you can see, sort of anchors itself very quickly on sort of the lower end of Leo's ontological expressivity in terms of just very simply syntax. These are the terms that we're going to use, and there's how the terms we're going to use relate to other terms. Way at the top on C, we have someone who might aim more for the more conceptual or the logic-based standards, but as you can see, those take a lot more time. And sort of the tension that we talked about at the interoperability workshop last year was this basic tension that always occurs between standards communities and between what I'll call theoretical or academic ontology communities, which is get it done quickly versus get it done right, okay? And so at the workshop, we actually had some discussions about these basic set of tensions between those two communities. Now I'm going to move to slide number 6, which is actually the slide that captures pretty much what I wanted to talk about today, which were the tensions between a theoretical ontology community, which I have on my slide if you're looking at it in color, as blue, and the standards and the tensions between a standard community that wants to get something done very quickly. And I'm just going to mention what these standards are very quickly in light of the kinds of tensions that I've seen myself as a player in both communities. Bullet number one says, get it done completely right. What I would call the idea of going and coming up with a perfect ontology for accounting or business process interoperability versus what the standards community was is get it working now. As a matter of fact, I was quite surprised when we had the interoperability workshop last year that had a high number of practitioners, how many people were willing or wanting to settle for the good as opposed to the perfect. As a matter of fact, they even had a logo or an axiom that stood for that. They said, the enemy of the good is often the perfect. And they thought that, for instance, in trying to develop an interoperability standard for accounting, one of the things that they saw as an impediment was academics sitting around saying, let's try to do the very best we can do as opposed to let's sort of taking what current practice is right now and try to embody that in the current standard. The second bullet says the basic tension is between trying to get a model that really does a good job of modeling e-commerce reality, a scientific model, versus trying to take very simply what we have as present practice right now and try to embody that in some kind of a standard. Try to get what we have now that's good enough. Let's get it out there. This is particularly a broadcast standard. What Ed did before when he talked about an exchange standard versus an interface standard also applies here. An awful lot of the reality models that we had for business collaboration were what Ed characterized as interface standards, whereas certainly the present practice model for broadcast standards was more what he called an exchange standard. I had never heard that particular dichotomy before, and perhaps that will lend some insight into the basic set of tensions that we were talking about it. On my third bullet there, it says the tension between making a wrong branch versus making a permanent branch. The practitioners say, let's get it working now, and if it's wrong, we can undo it and go back and do it right. Well, whenever I think of somebody doing that, I always think of the U.S. measurement standards. Whatever happened hundreds of years ago or 150 years, they clearly took a wrong branch off and without waiting for the metric system to actually be established and evolved, and which leads to some kind of a credibility gap. But a lot of people think if you do it wrong now, well, we can work with it, and then we can just undo it. And I think, like I said, the measurement standards in the U.S. show that that always is not the case. Once a standard becomes entrenched in some way or fashion, undoing the effects of the wrong branch is much, much harder. And I think the academic people thought whatever branch you take or whatever way you initially head is going to be a permanent branch, and you have to make sure that the first set of steps in some way are constrained toward moving toward the better or the ideal goal. Bullet number four is sort of a redo of bullet number one, but it is interesting the basic practitioner theorist tension there. Practitioners really anchor on being successful. And by being successful, this almost goes back to something that Barry Smith mentioned about a half an hour ago. To them, it means get users and get past the tipping point. In other words, get it out there. Even if it isn't the best standard possible, get people to use it. It can morph into something that's a little bit better. But what's really critical is to get past the tipping point in terms of an established, I think Barry called it like a telephone network, what I'll call is a getting past the tipping point, toward the basic tension of being right, trying to make sure the types of things you're doing have been exhaustively evaluated against the standards of the domain you're in and against the standards of ontology, which I think of as computer science standards. And then there are, and last bullet there is there are some basic tensions between to working in these worlds. I'm a professor, so I'm used to working with journals and referees and not used to working with national bodies, and I find that trying to get work past one group of people is very, very different. There's a lot more, I hate to say this, politics involved in national bodies. Sometimes you've got to realize the national bodies that you're talking about are hot on certain kinds of standards, and you have to show some sympathy toward that national body and what they're trying to get done, as opposed to what you're trying to do in your own national body. For instance, there were some very critical ideas that I did in the accounting and economic open EDI ontology that were rejected by my own national body, the U.S., and pretty much accepted by the other one. So I actually had to go back and take some of the work that I had there and take it out. It also turns out, I think, that when you're working in the two different standards groups, like a theoretical ontology community versus a standards community, you've got to realize they have different ideas and different goals. For instance, the ideal theorists often work with ontologies at the very high level, which I had here in my slide number two. But the practical people always need to sort of come down from what I would call the OMG M2 level down to the M1 level and the M0 level. So, for instance, if you're talking about something like an economic resource, they want to talk about how can I represent an instance of that economic resource, or how can I identify what an instance is of that economic resource, or is there a market transaction or a market issue that will actually establish the value. So I think an awful lot of theory people talk about concepts at almost too high a level, and the standards people want to talk about, if indeed I use this standard, what symbol can I use to represent an instance of that, and how can I establish it in an open marketplace? So those are the things I think I see as the sort of the comments, the tensions between these two groups. And I hope when we actually have the summit, we'll talk about how, if you're going to use theoretical ontological standards, how do you reconcile some of those with the sort of where does the rubber hit the road? So, and then my last slide, I just wanted to talk about some recent workshops that have been actually talking about this. We did have an NSF standard last year, an NSF workshop last year, where we talked about the two basic tensions between an ongoing practical, get it done now, get toward the tipping point standards community versus let's try to do it right, move further on up the Oberst kind of standard, interoperability standard. And then we just recently concluded with a workshop that we actually had on business ontologies that was done in Stockholm. I put down the basic URLs for both of those. So with that, I think I'm going to stop. Those are my sort of insights from working on both sides of the community, and I'm going to turn it back over to Michael, who can turn on to the next speaker. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Quite informative and a nice perspective on the relationship between the ontology and standards communities. Our final panelist for today is Conrad Bock from the National Institute of Standards and Technology. He'll be presenting some ideas on ontologies and standards, content, and languages. Conrad has been working at NIST for the past, I guess, what, six, almost 7 years now. On the ontology side, he's been working on the process specification language. But on the standard side, he's been working with OMG on a kind of a more ontological basis for UML. As well, he's worked with some of the HL7 groups. And so, Conrad, star 3 to unmute. Oh, is Conrad there?
Maybe not.
I thought I heard him come in. Let's see here.
Okay. Conrad, you'll have to do star 3 to unmute your phone and make sure your own phone is not...
Oh, thank you, Peter.
Oh,
that helped.
Great.
Okay, Conrad, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Michael. So this, I was just going to give a perspective on two different ways that ontologies could be applied in standards that have very different effects, but sometimes are hard initially to discern the difference. These two apologies are typically implied as, from their root in the word being and so on. They define classes of actual things. So they'll define classes of cars or boats and that sort of thing. And these are meant to categorize or classify actual things, actual cars or cars that are will exist in the future or if you're designing them and so on. And then the other way you might use them is to define a language. And these languages then are used to define what might typically be called an ontology. That is, they themselves are just languages for expressing things about cars or ships and so on, like a product modeling language might be used for that. So if we go on to the third slide. So if you're going to do a typical ontology and just defining what I call the content, you take your ontology language, which has elements like class, property, and so on. You make, quote, instances of those, and that is how you're creating your ontology. So you make a class of cars, a class of small cars, and so on. You can make taxonomies with subclassing. And you can further instantiate these things into representations of individuals. And these are supposed to be records of the existing things or things that will exist, but they're the actual. And in this mode, the product models, those things you see there, car and small car, those are classes, and they can be specialized from each other to form taxonomies and instantiated for individual things. They can't capture the properties of the classes themselves, such as their author, or, for example, in product modeling, you have elements that are requirements and elements that are the designs. You want to be able to link those and say that the design satisfies the requirement and so on. And those properties that are at the level of the class itself can't be recorded this way because the actual property, the values, properties given actual values only at the individual. So, for example, here if you said car has a property weight, you don't mean that the class itself has a weight. What you mean is John's car and Mary's car. The individual cars have weights. So, this is how ontologies are typically used when they're used in that way of in that from that root of being. They're about the things that actually exist or will exist. If you go to the next slide, this layers on these layers you've heard about the OMG names. They gave numbers to these things because they had to keep them all straight. The individual things are at a level they call M0. The what they call the models, or in our terms, the ontology, is at M1. And then the language you use to define your ontology is the ontology language, is at what's called M2. And this just helps you keep straight what function each of these elements is serving. The top one is a language that you express your domain knowledge in. The ontology captures those categories in your domain. And then the bottom one is the actual things in the world that you're categorizing. We go to the next slide. When you use an ontology to define a language, it's very different. For example, you might take the same ontology language you used before, except now when you instantiate, for example, class, you don't use it for, to say, a car or a class of cars or a class of ships. You say a product model. And this is meant to be something that's in the language, a part of a product modeling language. Of course, there'd be many other elements in that language. But when you instantiate that, you get models. You get models of a car, models of a small car. Those are product models there at the bottom. Now, the thing to note is those things at the bottom aren't classes. Only the thing in the middle, the product model, is a class, because it's an instantiated from class. The other things are instantiated from product models, so they're product models, not classes. And that means you can't instantiate them. That is, you can't get down to the individual level of John's car, Mary's car. You can't subclass them one from the other. You can't form taxonomies and so on. However, can capture the properties of the model. For example, product model may have a property called author. And then that means you could assign a particular author to car and small car. If you had other elements in your language, like requirements and so on, you could express relationships of the car model as it meets certain requirements and so on. If you go to the next slide, then layering on, again, these levels named as they're named as the OMG, we're actually one level up here. The at the bottom, we don't have individuals, we have the models. We have the category of cars, small cars, but they can't really categorize anything. They're not classes, they're just the models of the car. We have a modeling language now where the ontology language was. We have a modeling language that has terminology specific to the domain. So if this was an engineering domain, the language there would have product model, requirements, designs, all the words that an engineer would expect to see. And then in order to define that language, then what we were doing in the previous slide, we were actually using the ontology language at the next level up. We were using it to create the description of the language. And that description of the language isn't, of course, describing any particular cars or ships or anything. So product modeling language could describe any product. Go to the next slide. The important thing about this is that the language is, you define a language using ontology, we saw that it doesn't mean that the language you end up defining, for example, the product modeling language, it doesn't mean it supports the normal things you'd expect out of an ontology. For example, we saw that you really couldn't subclass small car from car because they aren't classes. And the analogy I was using to try to explain this is that suppose you had a dictionary that defined English words, but it defined them in French. Well, that wouldn't mean then that everything you can say in French you could say in English. You just happen to use French to define English words. You could have used Chinese, you could have used any other language. But the language you use to define those English words doesn't impart on English all the characteristics of those that other language. So when you use ontology languages like OWL or so on to define other languages like modeling languages and so on, it doesn't make those things ontological, really. You can't then use all the characteristics you normally expect out of an ontology in your product modeling language. We go on to slide 8. One solution to this is to combine these things so that when you define a product modeling language, for example, or any domain-specific language, what you do is you subclass off of the ontology language at the M2 level, which is the level which the languages are defined. And that way, your ontology or your model actually has both the characteristics of having classes and properties in the normal ontological way, but also they have the characteristics of the domain you're concerned with, because you can tell that that car is not just a class, but it's also a product model and would have various characteristics on it, like the author and so on. And it gives you the advantage that you can get down to the individuals, which is very important. For example, this domain and ERP systems that keep track of actual individual things in the enterprise. So there's two ways of applying ontology. Sometimes can get, when you first approach it, can seem the same, but they're very different characteristics. One is for defining languages, one is for defining characteristics of individual things. And it's possible to get the best of both worlds, but you know, that's something that we're still working on, so that the world of these domain-specific languages that are useful in engineering or in healthcare or anything like that, also have the capabilities that ontologies have. So in summary, the ontologies can be used at least in two ways in the standards. One is to create these classes of real things, real individuals. This is a typical semantic way that ontologies are used. Another one, even though it's an ontology language, you can use them to define domain-specific languages like product modeling languages or healthcare languages. In this case, you're defining syntax. You happen to be doing it with an ontology language, but you're just defining syntax, and it doesn't impart on that language the characteristics you normally expect of ontologies. So as far as OMG goes, classes of individual things. But as we try to apply ontologies, say at OMG or other standards bodies that are interested in mostly in defining languages, we just have to be cognizant of the fact that if we want the benefits of ontology, we have to apply them carefully in those areas when it, in order to get these languages to have the capabilities of ontology. So that
okay.
was it.
Thanks, Conrad. Okay, so just before we kick off the discussion, Peter, if you could just bring up the slides that I sent out. These were just meant to be more kind of, some talking points. They are posted on the other page called Resources. You can access it from the Telecon page. Towards the bottom of the Telecon page, I think there's something called Resources, and so I point to these notes, but I thought I would just mention them now as a kind of a way of maybe focusing some of the discussion and as kind of preparation for the Ontology Summit that will be at the beginning of April at NIST. So do we have the slides up? I can't see them.
Yes.
Okay.
Slide is coming up.
I just noticed I don't have slide numbers. Sorry about that. But if we move to the second slide entitled Challenge, one of the questions, I guess the overall arching question here is that we want to address is how can ontology support the development, the analysis, and the extension of information standards in industrial domains? Now, this may be, you know, a bit of something for discussion. You know, exactly what is the scope that we're addressing here? Are we, what are these information standards that we're addressing? But that can be something for discussion. The next slide, slide three, discussion questions. I just wanted to outline a few possible applications of ontologies in standards development and evaluation. One, I think, which is perhaps raised by Barry earlier, was that we can design ontologies that formalize either ambiguously defined concepts within existing standards or perhaps kind of identify and make explicit the semantics that is currently implicit in the natural language documentation. I think Ed raised this point as well. So that is perhaps one role that ontologies can play, is to bring the informal intended semantics out of natural language and bring it into a form that then other software can manipulate. The second point, second question, which is something else that Barry has talked about in the past, I didn't emphasize it as much today, but this also, I think, Conrad addresses this too, is the idea of ontological analysis of existing standards, identifying kinds of potential problems, semantic ambiguities, conflicts between the natures of instances and classes in existing standards, and to use this kind of ontological analysis to perhaps re-engineer existing standards to remove some of this ambiguity. The next slide. Can existing ontologies be used to support the integration of existing standards? So one, you know, the cliche, the wonderful thing about standards is that there's so many of them. Sometimes one of the other problems is how to, when you have projects or scenarios where you need to have multiple standards work together, sometimes that embarrassingly fails miserably. And so the idea would be, are there any ontologies out there right now that can be used to support this integration or maybe even harmonization? And then the final question would be kind of looking a little more in the future, are there any emerging standards or standards that are currently under development that can really benefit from ontologies as they exist now, or perhaps to identify ontologies that can be used in the final specification of these standards? So rather than reengineering existing standards, the idea is to infuse the standards process with ontologies as early as possible. I just had a couple of potential benefits here. on these slides, the notion of improved quality of standards leading to more robust implementations, perhaps automatic, semi-automatic conformance checking, and, like I said, the semantic integration of standards. The last slide was the panelists. I originally thought this would be at the beginning, but because of time constraints, I'm just coming at the end. But those are just a few questions I thought might help focus some of the discussion. But other than that, we'll just open it wide up now. Questions for any of the speakers or any other issues that perhaps came up during the presentations and ideas that people have.
Okay.
Howard Mason, you have your hand up.
Sorry I'm late. I was stuck in traffic for 2 hours on the way back from a standards meeting. Couple of points on Bill McCarthy's presentation. It's interesting to note that you took standardizers as being the pragmatic guys and ontologists being the theorists. That's kind of how real industry looks at the standardizers. So we're actually, from an ontology point of view, we're twice removed from industry. So that's going to be quite an interesting bridging exercise. I would also point out that the standards bodies are not your problem. Standards bodies are small groups of administrators. They're driven by their membership, which tends to be industry and trade associations. So standardizers aren't them, that's us, actually. In the UK British Standards, there's 200 people and 30,000 working on the committees. So that's where we need to address this activity. I would also note from the Michael's helpful slides that, yes, that's the sorts of questions that we need to be looking at in terms of very specific ontologies and that can be used. And coming up before our session next week, we will have a very practical example of existing standards which could be represented as ontologies, which cover a whole range of components of factory elements, and we're looking at how those might be integrated in a big picture. And we're probably talking there a couple of 100 standards, each of which could be expressed in ontological form, and we need to find some way of integrating them. I think that's actually at the high end of a challenge we could set, but it's an indication of the sorts of problems that we're having to address in industrial circles. Comment ends.
Thanks, Howard. Yeah, actually, your first point is also important to emphasize. We should never think of this as ontologies versus standards. I think it's a point of ontology collaborating with standards to really have an impact in industry. And I think that's a point well worth emphasizing. Joel Bender, you have your hand up on the discussion and chat room.
Yes, I have some questions for Ed, actually. Have you explored the use of Delish as a cooperative language for being able to build ontologies? And how about other kinds of more readable syntaxes for OWL, like the Manchester syntax? Do you find that any of those kinds of things will be able to help you develop an ontology or help people cooperate in the development?
Star 3 to unmute.
Ed?
Sorry, I had to get my line unmuted.
Okay.
I figured out how the protocol works anyway. In fact, actually, Dylan, the Manchester syntax is actually quite usable. I don't think there's a real we can argue about how usable, but it's certainly a great deal bit more better than XML. And what you actually see a great many ontologies that are ultimately going to be OWL ontologies get drawn with these, you know, balls and wires diagrams, in which, of course, you can express basically what are the classes and what are the properties, but period. You can't capture any of the constraints that are, you know, available in the OWL language, whereas the Manchester syntax can. So I mean, it really is, it's a case of, the problem is the Manchester syntax isn't in the standard. Right? And there are, for varying reasons, we don't want to talk about the politics of academics, but while Bill was talking about the politics of standards, but the fact is that there's academic politics involved there as well, and there are other folk whose attitude is, yeah, well, you know, what Manchester does is what Manchester does, and what Derry does is what Derry does, and so on. And so there are going to be other community, there are other issues in the politics of what service language you're going to have. The problem with no agreement on service language is that it inhibits an awful lot of education. Because you don't want to try to teach students how to model, especially, you know, middle-aged students who are trying to learn this, you know, by the side of their profession, you know, how to model in OWL if, in fact, you don't have a book, right? And you certainly don't want to do it in XML. And that's the problem. I mean, so, anyway, been done. And I don't really know, I mean, you mentioned Gelishan. I don't know that. But I will confess ignorance.
Okay. Yeah, well, I'll take the rest of these questions out to the mailing list. Thank you.
So, Ed, you were actually up next in the queue.
I actually wanted to raise a question with one of your slides. I was the one called discussion questions. Let me see what. What I noted here is what Howard just raised, I think, is a problem that I think people, at least as far as I'm concerned, confuse. The only way that you can, you know, use ontologies to integrate standards is to create the master ontology that has all of the concepts in all of them related in some way. If the standards were independently developed and they use, for example, different terminologies, it's going to take, you know, a tremendous amount of additional knowledge to develop some ontology that's going to somehow unify this. And I mean, you and Mike Ushel published a paper on Mike Kreninger and Ushel published a paper on exactly this some years ago. Right, that you end up having to have a master ontology, or you have to do some kind of point-to-point reconciliation of the individual ontologies. So having an ontology doesn't solve the standards integration problem at all, as far as I'm concerned. You know, you have to have an ontology to do that, maybe, but that's a separate ontology. And I guess that was the question that I was worried about is, what ontologies we should be designing, the push that I was making, that I wanted is, I'd first of all just like to see people who are making the standards make ontologies as part of the standard. Okay, and I'll stop there. I mean, in lieu of, you know, even if what they made is an ER model, as Bill was describing, or a UML model, you know, if you can convert that thing to an ontology, and by and large you have the knowledge there to do that, you know, that's a great step forward. It gives us an opportunity to do all of these reasoning operations. Anyways, I'm done.
Okay, I'll just make a brief comment on that. I don't think it's necessary that there has to be one master ontology that integrates all the standards. And I might even take an even more radical position. I really don't believe that ontologies are designed to impose the meanings of terms. I really feel that what they do is they allow the more explicit specification of multiple meanings so that people can actually recognize what their commonalities and differences are in the terms that they use. There are going to be times when people really fundamentally disagree on the meanings of terms, and maybe different standards kind of, you know, will embody different conflicting meanings. In that case, they would not be integrated. But I think the danger, and the reason why I would say ontologies can be used to support the integration of standards, is to make a lot of the implicit knowledge explicit, because it's the implicit knowledge that causes a lot of problems. It's when people believe that two terms mean the same thing, or when they believe that their terms are actually not equivalent to each other, that's what causes a lot of the barriers in integration. So it's not, ontologies are not going to be a kind of a magic pill that will impose, I'm using my metaphors here, I don't think ontologies are going to be something that can impose integration, but they definitely can be used to support it by identifying what can be integrated and what shouldn't be integrated. Okay. Jerry Raddick, you're up on the queue.
Hi. I want to second what you're just saying, that I don't think we're anywhere near the point where we could have a single ontology for everything. Within TC-184, SC-4, we can't even agree on a single data model for catalogs, let's say, electronic catalogs. So we try to extend that to the whole world. It's just not realistic to think you're going to have a single ontology. And it doesn't really make sense because, you know, just looking at the slides for the OBO Foundry modular organization, you know, in the biology area, you know, I could see a lot of more layers that could be added, you know, like chemistry ontology and a physics ontology, a subatomic particle ontology. And, you know, whether you need those things or not, depends on your domain, what you're trying to do. And if you try to impose it on everybody, just you get a horrible performance and probably the whole effort will grind to a halt. I also had a question for Ed. Were you advocating that everybody, that we actually use the OMG modular MDA or just use their kind of approach?
Quickly, Jerry, I believe we can use the approach. But secondly, I think that because that approach is being successfully sold to software engineering people, it can be successfully sold as a foundation for what I think of as the ontological approach. Model the knowledge, then figure out what the implementation is going to be.
Well, I looked at it a little bit. It seems very, very complex and hard to get up to speed on.
Oh, you mean the MDA document?
The materials that they have, I can't comment on the software.
Okay, sorry. It's not the software, and I should have said I will disavow the use of any existing OMG documents on MDA. It has become an outrageous albatross in the sense that whatever Richard Soley originally intended has been transmogrified into nonsense by the vendor community. And I'll just let it go at that. I am not a fan of what OMG has written about MDA in the last 3 years. It's just junk.
We need a simplified approach. And even Corba, for example, Corba was supposed to be platform independent, and yet now it's just treated with another platform, and they put another layer on top of it. So, we need a level of simplicity, I think, in this ontology world if we're going to make things really work. And I think web services is about as far as I would go in terms of complexity.
That's an implementation technology.
That's just in terms of the level of complexity. And I'm not saying we should actually adopt web services, but the level of complexity is about as far as I think you need to get the broad community to adopt.
Okay. Deborah McPherson? Deborah, you have your hand up in the queue.
Star 3.
So while we wait for Deborah, she might be off somewhere. I just also wanted to raise a point. Nicola Guarino had hoped to attend today's meeting, but wasn't able to. He sent me several documents that they had kind of developed within one of the European Union projects. I'm just waiting for his final okay to post them to our site. And he wanted to emphasize and to inject a strong dose of realism and pragmatism to all of this. They tried to do an ontology-based, standards integration effort and were kind of overwhelmed by the sheer magnitude of an endeavor. And so he wanted to caution us on not being too ambitious, but to also have a much smaller scope with some clear objectives. So that otherwise we'll just get lost in the swamp here. Okay, so Deborah can't get unmuted. So she posted a little note to Ed's point. Ed, I'll just read the question to you then, Ed. She would like to build ontologies into standards, but needs some help and good examples. Can you point to any good examples of standards with ontologies built in?
Am I unmuted? I'm not sure.
Yes, you are.
Oh, okay. Actually, right off the top of my head, no. I think, however, that if you look at what I was suggesting is that what I do see is standards emerging with what are identifiably formal information models in them, which are descriptions of what we mean. And there are standards that are appearing with much more carefully written sections that are so-called definition sections, which really are, you know, which really are very expressive terminology models. They're probably one less than what we would hope for an ontology, but at least, you know, we're finally starting to see efforts that are professionally built in that line. And I know that Howard Mason is on now, and I suspect that he has actually got some elements to propose in that vein, because I know that that is an area of work of some of the communities he's working in.
And
in fact, Howard, I'll yield the floor to you if you're on.
Yeah, I'm here. What we've seen is the use of OWL to support reference data as extensions to some of the newer STEP AP, such as 239 for product lifecycle support and 233 for systems engineering. And you can consider the whole reference data pack of about 12,000 classes for the ISO 15926 structure for oil and gas as being an ontology. Furthermore, we have some research work going on. The S-10 project in Europe has come up with ways of ontologizing the existing data models. To some extent, though, our investment in information there has been slightly damaged by the ontology process because we're losing a lot of the relationships and having to rely on things like first-order logic to recreate them. But in some cases, while it gives us a great deal of flexibility, what we don't need in a standard is lots of flexibility because people will interpret it differently, implement it differently, and interoperability just disappeared.
And then I would just also add PSL, the process specification language, is the ontology for the standard ISO 18629. I think in that case the standard is quite closely identified with the ontology that it contains. And there are also several other efforts. At one point, there were several other efforts within the part of ISO that was doing enterprise modeling, enterprise engineering sorts of standards. And there was always an intention to have those built upon standards, but I'm not really sure what the status of those projects are anymore. Let's see. At one point, I saw Steve Ray's name in the queue.
Peter Yim here, if I may sort of add one more suggestion to answer Deborah's question. Not that I'm suggesting that's a good product, but it has been a sort of tried attempt and I think a good process. If one goes back onto the history of Ontolog, one will discover that we actually spun off from the OASIS UBL, Universal Business Language, technical committee. And all along, there has been efforts trying to use UBL as a basis, ontologize it, and make it into an ontologically based standard, starting from the early effort Adam Pease and others have put in to map the CCTS, the core component technical spec, to Sumo, all the way to more recent efforts in the OASIS SET technical committee that tries to build an OWL ontology that helps map between various standards, including UBL and others, that are based on the UNCFECT CCTS, the core component technical spec. So that process is, I guess, a referenceable process. And I think at least some of the steps were done right, although the entire effort has not been totally followed through. At least, I mean, the attempt to map it to an upper ontology, I think that is a major key, rather than sort of leaving things hanging. Without sort of grounding it to something that is upper and maybe very expressive, like something defined in first order logic. Back to you, Michael.
see. So right now in the queue, I'm not sure if these are hands that are still up or these are new hands that are up. Either Jerry, Deborah, or Howard, if you have any points that you wanted to say that haven't been raised yet, feel free to jump in now. Okay. Are there any other general comments from people who perhaps are not following in the chat session? Anybody else want to say anything at this point? Okay, so I think the plan then is next week, Howard Mason will be leading our next meeting. He already gave a teaser on what will be happening next week, and so that will be like our second telecon in preparation for the upcoming Ontology Summit. I would encourage people to also go to the additional information page. Let's see, where is that page?
If you're looking for my page, it's not up yet because we've been dealing with a dying relative for the last week. There'll be stuff up on it tomorrow indicating some of the key questions from the standards area. And I'm hoping to have presentations from guys, certainly in the SC4 environment, who have done ontology and ontology-based activities. So it'll give you an indication of where we're coming from. If that's okay?
Okay. Here it is. So if you go to the main Ontology Summit 2009 page, there are some key content pages there. Ontology community perspectives will be relevant to today's discussion. So I encourage people to post additional content information to that page. Right now, what's on that page is a slight version of what I posted in my slides. The idea will be that the content that people provide on these pages will provide the input for the actual summit when we meet face-to-face, and so that we can, I guess, more quickly arrive at some ideas that we can pull together into the communique. So today was the ontology community perspective, and next week is the gender community perspective, and soon after that will be the actual summit on April 6th and 7th.
Michael, this is Steve Ray.
Hey, Steve.
I just wanted to mention soon after that is the third. There's a third panel right at the week after Howard's panel. So in 2 weeks, there's a panel called Standards and Ontologies, and that's one where we're going to try and identify what would be perhaps candidate standards that the community here could pull together on and ontologize or re-engineer using more rigorous methods. So that in addition, is also preparatory to the face-to-face meeting, which is happening April 6th.
Right, so that telecon will be then March 26th.
Right, so this week, and then next week is Howard Mason's on the Sanders Community Perspective, and then a week after that is the identification of some candidate standards.
Excellent.
And while I have the floor, I just wanted, the reason I was raising my hand earlier, I didn't want to interrupt the technical discussion, but the registration for the face-to-face meeting is now open as of just a few hours ago. And I provided a link in the chat room, but you can also find it right on that Ontology Summit webpage. What we want people to do is register, if they're physically going to be at the meeting, to register. If they're remotely going to attend, don't register at the NIST website page. We're going to provide a separate means for doing that. Otherwise, NIST has to needlessly pay our conference facilities people a fee. If you physically show up, but if you're not going to physically show up, we don't want to have to pay that fee per person. That's all I had to say on that.
Right, and I just posted the link to the chat board, and also the link is on the Ontology Summit 2009 wiki homepage there, and both links to the NIST on-site registration as well as to the remote registration are also up. So if you're attending remotely, time to register too, not just the on-site attendees. And week's standards community's perspective. I know we have quite a few standards developing organization people involved in the organizing and the advisory committees, as well as in the general ontolog community. So please step up and volunteer your thoughts and contact Howard Mason, who will be chairing the session, so that we can get a broad perspective from various standards developers next week.
All right. Well, unless there are any other open issues?
I can't seem to get to the web page. It's Howard Mason. If you could record me as present part-time, I'd be grateful.
Okay. Well, I believe that would wrap it up. Thank you very much to all of our panelists, to Gary and Ed, Bill and Conrad, and thank you everyone else for attending and providing some very interesting questions and input. Hope to hear everyone at next week's meeting, and hope to see everyone at the Ontology Summit. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.